Loot Crate is a monthly subscription box service for epic geek and gamer items and pop culture gear. For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items, and more. Loot Crate is like having a friend who knows just what you love and surprises you with an awesome present every month. Loot Crate is more than just a subscription service. It's an entire community of fans that share their experiences and interact with each other around the unboxing of each month's crate. You have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific each month to subscribe and receive that month's crate. When the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. So make sure to head to lootcrate.com/Maltin and enter code M-A-L-T-I-N, that's my name, to save $3 on any new subscription. They also ship to Canada, Australia, and even the UK with more info on their website. Loot Crate guarantees $40 plus in value in every crate, sometimes even more. Every month there's a different theme, and all items are curated around that theme. Themes are inspired by major movie and video game releases, as well as pulling from pop culture franchises that we all know and love. So if this is the kind of stuff you enjoy and collect, try Loot Crate.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Well, hi, this is Leonard Maltin, and you're listening to Maltin on Movies without Jesse Maltin today, sorry to say. And she's really sorry because she's missing out on talking to my guest, the one, the only, Bryan Cranston. You are the one, the only, Bryan
Cranston. I hope so. Yes. The other guy was getting my work for a while.
Oh, that's a shame. Did you get, are there mail, too?
Crossing,
social security checks?
Residual checks.
Yes, right. Thanks. Did you ever get one of those, like, 1 cent residual checks?
Yeah, I've got them framed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it costs more to process that than it is. And no one's going to go to the bank with, I'd like to cash this check for 1 penny, please.
And yet that does happen.
Yes.
It still does happen. My gosh. Yeah. And you have been in, as a working actor, you have worked in so many episodic TV shows and things that there are those checks, and they diminish over the years.
Quite significantly, precipitously.
Which is why you want to keep working.
It's why you want to keep working. I guess that kind of model has changed so much. Just as we've seen, the model of television has changed drastically.
Yeah,
movies has changed incredibly as well. I'm about to start a movie with Richard Linklater. That is being produced by Amazon, and we have a window of theatrical release, and then it'll be on their platform and that sort of thing. So, it's just something that we're all just adapting to.
Yeah. It's ever changing.
Yeah.
It does not. Nothing in life stands still, but certainly not this business.
No.
You have seen quite a lot of it. I mean, you're not elderly, but I mean, in just the time you've been working.
Yeah.
There have been real revolutions. We've watched them all, all happen.
Yeah.
I mean, Malcolm in the Middle was a hugely popular show on what was then sort of an upstart network.
Yeah, basically. Fox had been around for a while, and it had Married with Children and things like that, and 21 Jump Street and those. And then this was, they were a full-fledged network by then. And this was, I think we shot that in, we started premiere was January of the year 2000 and ran for 7 years. Mm-hmm. So it was fun.
And then and we'll talk obviously about Breaking Bad, but Breaking Bad helped establish a new identity for another, this time cable network, AMC, which originally had been a classic movie network and was trying to get footing in a new, for a new definition, you might say, for what it was, doing original programming. Mad Men, of course, Matthew Weiner's brilliant show, was the one that really turned the tide for AMC.
Yes, it was.
And then they were looking for something to follow up.
Yeah, and we were fortunate to be on the coattails of Mad Men. Mm-hmm. They had premiered, and they made a big splash. Rightfully so. It was a fantastic show. And it put AMC really on the map again. Mm-hmm. And then followed up with Breaking Bad, and we kind of carved our own identity. And that. So now they had two mastheads.
Right.
And And then AMC, which wonderful people, very creative, very friendly. I just love them. They wanted to own their product because they were just licensees, mm-hmm. really, of those two shows. And so they created Walking Dead, and that just exploded internationally as well as domestically.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a certain fellow who owns the network we are broadcasting on who has also benefited from The Walking Dead. That's the fellow named Chris Hardwick who does The Talking Dead.
That's right.
Among other things. So
Chris
good
is,
for you,
is
Chris.
A friend. He's a great guy. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I've known
a
him.
A smart guy.
A smart guy. Known him for years. Mm-hmm. Not a smart aleck. He's a smart guy.
No, he's a smart guy. There's a big difference.
Yeah.
So again, we're talking about really, you know, not just changes, but almost, and it sounds like a negative word, but it's not, upheavals in the way television and the way entertainment is delivered to people at home. And now everybody's streaming.
Right.
And with the shows on Amazon and Netflix, you can get a whole season all at once if you choose to.
Right.
You can binge. You can watch at your own schedule. All of these changes. And yet it's just about good storytelling.
That's what it always boils down to mm-hmm. is, are we invested in this story and in these characters? Do we root for them? Do we root against them? Mm-hmm. Do we cringe when our characters make decisions that are antithetical to their you know, common health? And that's what it is. It's all about the story. Yeah. And that's the thing that grabs me first and foremost is the mm-hmm. story.
Yeah.
Not even the character. First, it's the story, the mm-hmm. overall story. Then if that's great, then I go to the character. Is this character important to the crux of this story?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, I'm even more interested. And then it's the director and who are the other actors involved and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we saw each other just a short time ago at the Telluride Film Festival, mm-hmm. and you were on your way from there to Toronto with a really unusual film called Wakefield.
Yeah.
Directed by Robin Swycord, very mm-hmm. fine screenwriter and occasional director, who also wrote this screenplay from a New Yorker short story by E.L. Doctorow. Mm-hmm. What an interesting movie and what a great part. It's almost a solo film. It's not quite, but it's almost a solo film narrated by its main character.
It was it's an old story, actually, mm-hmm. originally by Nathaniel Hawthorne, a short story mm-hmm. as well. And E.L. Doctorow Americanized it and wrote mm-hmm. it for The New Yorker. And that's where Robin got a hold of it. And Wakefield really addresses the idea of slowing down. And I think that's what got me, and I think how it's going to resonate with audiences, is that I think everybody in this day of high-tech world that we live in wants the opportunity to push the pause button mm-hmm. just every so often. I need to sleep. I need to shut down for a while. There's too much going on. How many times are we told, oh, you've got to watch this series and you've got to watch that series?
Yeah.
And you do. You want to. But it's like, oh, there's so many episodes. I can't. I want to commit to that? And you got to see these movies. And book reading has diminished, you know, which is another shame that has happened. But Wakefield is a story about a guy, a very successful man with the trappings of success, a wife, children, a beautiful home in Westchester County. And he pushes the pause button. He just steps out of his life for a short period of time. But then his reentry becomes nearly impossible for him.
Sure. He's created such an alternative life, if you can call it a life, for himself. Looking outside, or looking inside through a plate glass window, as it were, at what used to be his life.
Yeah.
And becoming more harshly critical of it and saying, do I want to go back?
Do I want
that? This is not a spoiler, folks, because this is the whole theme of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about.
He extracts himself from his life physically and thereby emotionally and intellectually as well. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things going on, abandonment issues with his wife and his children, but he didn't have any intention of any long term. It kind of turns out to be a longer, much longer time than even he imagined. And what happens as human beings, we are resilient and adaptable, and his family makes the adjustments necessary to move on.
Yeah.
And now that takes a whole nother, it takes it into a whole nother realm for him that he just can't cope with.
Such an interesting film. Now, I keep saying interesting, and there are people who would say, oh, there's a buzzword for... No, I don't mean that as a negative buzzword in any way. But let's face it, this is not a blockbuster-type movie that's going to open on 3,000 screens on a double feature with the next, big Hollywood tentpole film. It's a very thoughtful and provocative drama for people who still want adult, thoughtful, provocative dramas in their lives.
There are a number of us who do. I think Wakefield's success will be measured on the conversation afterward.
Mm-hmm.
If it stimulates conversation and disagreements, mm-hmm. That's where we will have won. Because mm-hmm. I think that's what good art should do.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't just be you look at it and go, okay, I'm done looking at it. Whether it's a painting or a dance or listen to a piece of music or a piece of performance art, you want to talk about it. You want to disagree
mm-hmm.
because we are our human experience is going to be different. Our backgrounds, our education, our influences are all different. And you gather with your friends. You've all just seen the same thing at the same time.
Yep.
And you will all have different opinions mm-hmm. of that's what makes art so fascinating.
Yes.
Endlessly fascinating.
I couldn't agree more. Now, what made you say yes to this film? What makes you say yes to any film? You've already outlined some of the reasons. You know, a good collaborator is a great story, an interesting character. But more specifically, you're busy. You're fortunate in that you're in demand right now. You're hot.
Well,
you're hot. You're a hot commodity. And so you have options.
Yes. I also have a pretty strong work ethic and come from a very blue-collar mm-hmm. upbringing, difficult childhood at times.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you know, when faced with an opportunity to achieve something, it was you grab it, you know, work while the sun is shining
type of
mentality. And I know that at some point the bloom is going to fall off this rose and the petals will go to the ground. And when that happens, I want to have completely explored all my options and done as much as I can because, you know, this fame and celebrity is an interesting beast and I'm still learning how to navigate through it. And it's not something that I ever really wanted. I wanted to be a working actor. And once that was achieved at 25 years old, I did adjust and I wanted to have more opportunity and to achieve more so that I can have a bigger pool to work in. So mm-hmm. really terrific writers and directors and producers to come together to create, you know, great projects. And that has happened, and much to my joy and surprise.
Yeah.
So I'm delighted. And choosing Wakefield or Argo or Breaking Bad or any of the things that I've done have always come – I've formulated a system that I call a CAPS, Cranston Assessment of Projects System.
Ooh.
Yes.
Ooh, let us in on this.
It is writer-centric. It is – focused on the story first. Mm-hmm. And I separate the story from the actual text that either sometimes, as you know, you can have a great story and yet the text or the play or the screenplay, mm-hmm. it didn't get it. Mm-hmm. It didn't capture it. And mm-hmm. it's so disappointing. So that's why I separate it. But first is the story. Am I compelled by the story? Am I moved by the story? It's the same thing when we read a book or watch a movie that moves us. That's what I'm looking for when I hear about a story. And then I assess the value of that text, whether if it's a play or if it's a screenplay. Does this support that great story that I heard? And if it's yes, great, fantastic. Two checks off the list. Then I go to the character? Is the character germane to the story? Is it mm-hmm. important to the story? Is that character integral to mm-hmm. you know, discovering what the possibilities of that story? And if so, then I go to the director, whether it's a play or whether it's a mm-hmm. film, to see if his or her vision is what I was sensing too. And there's a tremendous amount of trust then that you just give over and put in their hands. And, you know, it's like that trust exercise when you first get into an acting class. You mm-hmm. fold your arms and you fall backwards and mm-hmm. you are assigned a partner to catch you. And you don't know exactly or with 100% assurance that they will. Mm-hmm. You just have to trust that they will. And they do. And you go, oh, okay, so when we're on stage, when we're working on projects and talking about, we need to give that trust to them. And if you get burned, you get burned, and you learn. But you need to give over and somewhat let go of what you think something should be and allow that director to guide the story. Yeah, pretty much that. And then the other cast, I weigh in something that, you know, is only personal. Does it take me out of town? What does that sure. do to my, to, you know, my relationship with my wife and my daughter and all these things? And I, you know, decide accordingly.
Yeah, I've heard that there are some actors and directors who, if they open a script and it says sunset over Los Angeles, they say, I'm in.
there's a, you know, I just recently finished last year, I did 3 movies in a row that shot in Los Angeles. Unheard of.
It is unheard of.
I shot the LBJ mm-hmm. thing all the way for HBO, and I shot this movie, Wakefield, mm-hmm. here in Los Angeles, and a movie that comes out in December, a comedy, a broad comedy called Why Him, mm-hmm. that was also shot here. Mm-hmm. So 3 in a row. Very rare.
Well, good for you.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Sleeping in your own bed at night. I know. What a luxury.
What a change.
Yeah. When you've spoken pretty openly about, you know, some of the difficulties you had, you know, your family life growing up in the San Fernando Valley mm-hmm. and here in Los Angeles. And you didn't have an easy time of it. Do you know what drew you to acting? And what made you stay with it?
I do. I just recently, I wrote a book. I have a copy. I want to give you. I don't know why. I didn't know if I could write a book. Mm-hmm. But I like short stories. Mm-hmm. And I think primarily because so recently, not even so recently, but in the past 20 years, I've been so busy. The short story enables me to dig in, enjoy being told a story, and then finishing it, and then moving on to something else. I can't tell you how many novels I've started and had to put down because oh, you got to read this script, you got to read this, you got to do this, you got to do this. Oh, okay. And then I get back and I go, I don't remember I got to start from the beginning.
Yeah.
So my interest in writing the book, which I call A Life in Parts, because it really covers my life as in my personal life and in my acting life, mm-hmm. and that comes out next week. I wanted to write the stories of my life and be really open and truthful, and it follows my challenging childhood all the way through to that discovery of when I wanted to becoming an actor, some terrible jobs that I had, some great jobs that I had, including Breaking Bad. And it really covers a lot. And there's 60 short stories with it, personal and professional and my philosophy on acting and things mm-hmm. like that. It was really a great time. I really enjoyed it.
I admire the fact that you enjoy talking to students. You've talked to my class at USC. Yeah. I know that when your daughter was attending SC as an acting student, you spoke to her classes as well.
Yeah. I like doing it. I want to continue doing it. Mm-hmm. Will you invite me back?
Yeah.
Okay. I do. I think it's a responsibility. I take it as a responsibility of me to see if I can help the next generation through the choppy waters of a career, and from someone who was in the water.
Right. Whose career do you admire? What are some of the careers that you admire? Not just on both levels, in terms of the quality of the work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's lots of great actors, but also in the quality of the way they've maintained and sustained their careers.
First and foremost comes to mind is Tom Hanks, who is a friend. And my wife and Brita Wilson have been friends since they were both 18 years old, starting in this business. And my wife, Robin, was in their wedding 28 years ago, something like that. So we've known them for a long time. Tom has been very generous, and I've worked for Tom for, I think, four different projects. And I've watched him behave on a set, interact with actors, how he conveys a congenial relationship with them, and he's there to have fun, but with a keen eye on getting the work done, which is exactly what we're there for. But his manner and his demeanor and the way he respects all aspects and all departments is remarkable, and it's doable. I realized through him, it's like, yeah, you can be that guy. You can be that good guy and respect everyone and be kind and still get the work done. And even if you get frustrated, even if you have disagreements and arguments, artistically, you can maintain respect for that, and you don't need to lose that. And then his relationship with Rita is wonderful, and how he has navigated celebrity at that level is astonishing. And he carves out time for his wife and his kids and for, you know, vacations, because you need to. And I've picked up from that, carving out those moments, despite how wonderful my life has turned out and how many opportunities have come my way. I have to then tell my agency, the month of April, nothing is to be done. You know, there will not be a movement of this. It's not going to happen.
Wow. And I really admire that, because I've been a freelance writer since I was a kid, and I suffer from that problem of never saying no.
Well, that and there's a lot of similarities between writers and directors and actors coming up, because when you're offered a job, you say yes. You have your mortgage to pay.
And also, what if you say no, then maybe they won't call you back the next time.
That's right. That's right.
It's a disease.
Or
a curse or something.
There is a sense of unease, and it's just now that I've, in the past couple years, that I've been able to get to really a point where I could say no and yet, like Tom, maintain a sense of courtesy and calm and consideration.
Does it make you even more impatient with people who then don't have that grace, don't have those sensibilities on a set?
Yes. It makes me realize I don't want to be around that.
Yeah.
And now I'm 60 years old. And I've been in this business for 37 years. And I know what I like and what I don't like, a lot from Tom and a lot from other people that I've worked with that I admire greatly.
Name some others, if you
will. Well, Dick Van Dyke is a role model, and I admire him. And a kind, generous man. Jim Garner was that way. Angela Lansbury is still in a more reserved sort of way, but very kind and sweet. And I got to tell you, Leonard, in the 37 years, there's probably three people I would not want to work with again.
Next episode of this podcast. we're going to tease it now. We're not going to do it now. Because why spill that right away?
That's right. I can't, because you're on that list.
Thank you. I'm honored.
No.
Only three, and I made the list?
No.
That's great.
It's true. It's like it's a generous group, and there's no reason why you can't have a good time while you're doing something that you love to do.
Yeah. No, in terms of interviews, people will ask me. I mean, there's a period I did a lot of junket interviews as well as more personal one-on-one interviews. I've had very few bad experiences. Very few.
Yeah.
I mean, there are always some people who, you know, who don't get it or who are, you know, who are just...
uncooperative.
Yeah, yeah. Or
belligerent.
Or, you know, or too much in their own head or their own ego.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just on the fingers of one hand, that's all.
I think if you, I mean, I adapted this sensibility a long, long time ago. The business doesn't owe me a thing. Mm-hmm. The world doesn't owe me a thing. Mm-hmm. You got to work hard. There's no substitute for work. There mm-hmm. isn't. There mm-hmm. just isn't. Not for me, anyway. Yeah. Now, maybe there are a handful of people who are just so naturally gifted mm-hmm. that they can just show up and they're like amazing. The rest of us have to work very, very hard to make it appear that it looks easy.
Well, but that's one of the things that interests me about acting is that there was a great director from the Hollywood era of the 20s, 30s, and 40s named Clarence Brown. Mm-hmm. Worked with Garbo a lot, made a lot of good movies. He made The Yearling in the mm-hmm. 40s. He made some really first-rate films, and he made National Velvet.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was asked toward the end of his career by my friend Scott Iman, who was doing a long interview with him, who was the greatest actor he ever worked with, he said, without hesitation, Mickey Rooney.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott said, why? He said, why? Because on the set of National Velvet, we'd be getting a scene ready, and Mickey would be on the phone with his bookie and also writing a song with a pal of his at the piano and being distracted in seven different directions. And we'd say, Mickey, we need you. The AD would say, now, all right. And he would drop everything. He was professional. When it said time, he was ready, came on, hit his mark, and would do a scene that would break your heart. Break your heart.
Yeah.
And when they said cut, he'd go back to his bookie and the piano and the songwriting and everything like that. Like nothing. Now, that's a gift, I guess.
It's a savant, actually,
yes, yeah,
in that
so.
Sense, to be able to have that kind of... I've, you know, if you work a lot, you get to a point where you can find an odd sense of comfort in that naturally uncomfortable environment where it's very technical and there's a lot mm-hmm. of machinery around, a mm-hmm. lot of people around, talking and things, mm-hmm. and you are the one... You know, you and a couple other people mm-hmm. are the only ones in to be seen in the final product.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to carve out your own place to make your work experience a calm one for you, a relaxed one, so mm-hmm. that you can focus and create and be imaginative. So you just, once you do that, it's like a muscle, and you know what you need, and you can get what you need without being... you know, crass or...
Yeah.
Or,
now, what I've never understood, now you've directed episodes of some of your, uh-huh. your shows, which means you've directed yourself.
I have.
And I've never, of course, this existed long before the video, you know, playback existed.
Yeah.
Charlie Chaplin did it 100 years ago. But now being able to watch yourself must be a great asset. But besides that, I've never understood, because it's two different... skill sets, it seems to me, because you use the word relax. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, part of acting is being in a calm, focused space,
mm-hmm.
Which is the opposite of directing. Focusing is the same thing, of course, being aware of every
yeah.
single thing going on. But that's just it. The director has to be aware of everything going on. The actor should only be aware of what he is supposed to be conveying.
Yeah.
How do you do both?
I always start with a compliment when I'm directing myself.
Nice.
Brian, that was a beautiful take. Let's do it again. No, it's like, you know, that what, like anything else, it's how well prepared you are.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-production is exceedingly important when mm-hmm. I'm directing a piece that I'm also in, because I have to get as many things off that checklist as I possibly can before the cameras start rolling and you're burning up a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I also depend heavily on my assistant directors and mm-hmm. the writer who's usually on the set, mm-hmm. writer, producers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm very open and very communicative with them, say, here's what I need to get in this setup when I'm in it or when my character leaves and I can't see what is being done afterward. This is what I'm looking for. And, yeah, you do have playback that Jerry Lewis created mm-hmm. for his own self-directing movies. And you do get a chance to see it. And interestingly enough, you think that because I've done it so much, I look at it from an objective viewpoint. I will then say, talking about me, the actor in it, I'll go, well, why did he leave then? He should leave a little earlier. We need to have him leave a little earlier and have her come down the stairs. And, you know, I'm just like, yeah. I step out of it and I look at this mm-hmm. from an objective viewpoint. And I think that that's the key to it. And, you know, directing is hard. And a lot harder than acting is, maybe because I've just been doing it a long time. But an actor focuses on the self. What does my character need? What does my character want? Who's in my character's way? Mm-hmm. It's very self-centered.
Yeah.
And where actors get in trouble is if they take that self-centered nature, which is necessary to create a character and stay in that character and drive in that character. Mm-hmm. If you then take that into your personal life, what do I need? What do I want? Who's in my way? That's where the transition from an acting life to a personal life can get muddy.
Yeah, yeah. What keeps you centered then? What is it? Is it your wife?
My wife, Robin. She's mm-hmm. brilliant. We've been together for almost 30 years now. Mm-hmm. And she's... you know, just calm and very emotional and very loving and supportive. And she's really, truly a remarkable person in that she's so steady. She has a good disposition. She's a happy person, almost always happy and almost always looking for the good in people and in her life. And when she sees a firefly, she gets giddy. A sunset, she crunches her shoulders and mm-hmm. and just exudes that kind of appreciation for life. Mm-hmm. And that's it's not only loving to me, but it's calming to mm-hmm. me. It's a touchstone. It makes me know that, okay, that's real.
Yeah.
That's real, and that's what I want to come home to.
Yeah.
And we have our daughter, we're so proud of. Taylor has, you know, got a career of her own now going. She stars in a show on MTV that premieres next month on November 15th called Sweet Vicious. And I visited her on her set as she has visited me before on my sets.
And she goes by the name?
She goes by Taylor Dearden,
okay.
Which is Robin Dearden,
okay.
And she goes by her name. She wanted to kind of have her own identity,
of course,
and I get
of course.
It, and that's great. And it's fantastic, and she's so good, and the show is really good, and so I wish her well.
Wonderful,
yeah.
Wonderful. All right, tell us about being on a set, maybe when you were young, maybe later on. And just being blown away by another actor, watching another, observing another actor at work, up close.
So many. Garner and mm-hmm. Richard Kiley, mm-hmm. Geraldine Page.
Mm.
People that...
Well, you wouldn't be the only one to say Geraldine Page.
No.
One of the great theater actresses, and nominated for, what, 7 Academy Awards, something like that, you know?
Brilliant. Remember Marion Seldes?
Yes.
Beautiful actor. Just recently passed.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate to direct her in a comedy series, television. She didn't do a lot of television. She did theater, stage, mm-hmm. stage.
Right.
And never missed a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And lovely. No one else in Hollywood knew who she was except me. And I was, and she was game. And she was elderly at that time.
Yeah.
And she was game. And I said, Marion, I wonder if, I think it would be funny if, as you collapse in your little tipsy stupor, that you slid down the stairs, you know, bonk, 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 bonk. Would you want to try it? Could we put a pad on, or is that not possible? She goes, oh, no, darling, why don't we take a crack at it, you know? And it was just so sweet that she was game.
Mm-hmm.
So many. Lloyd Bridges was fun mm-hmm. to work with. And, mm-hmm. and you know, of course, Tom, I learn a lot from Tom Hanks and what he brings to it. I'm sure I'm forgetting. And
well, and you got to be directed by his longtime friend and colleague, Steven Spielberg, in Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
Now, what would you tell us about being in a scene directed by Steven Spielberg?
At first, you think it's going to be daunting, right? Because of all the baggage in your mind about, oh, Steven Spielberg, Steven Spielberg. Right. But he diffuses that immediately, and he loves actors, just loves them. And like a son, you want to present something to him that he's going to be proud of, and and in Saving Private Ryan, I had a whole routine worked out. My character was an one-armed colonel, and I was supposed to pour
was
some
it written that way.
Yeah, it was written that way, and I was working on. Well, I worked on a backstory about when he lost his arm and that sort of thing, and he was supposed to be, you know, having a cup of saucer. So I worked out a whole thing with a demi-tasse, a cup and saucer and a spoon, tap, tap, put it on that with one arm, put it on my desk as I'm reading a report. I wasn't even looking at it, you know, and I wanted to show him. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, we're just going to push straight in. You know? One thing that Steven will do is that he's cutting the movie in his head a lot. And so he knows what angles and what setups he's going to use for the scene. And we would be doing a scene, he'll go, cut. And immediately actors think we messed up.
Right.
And he goes, no, no, it's fine. It's good. That's all I need. We're not going to use the rest from this angle. And he'll move. And, oh, okay. So before you get used to that, it's like, it's interesting. But, yeah.
Is that what you're looking for mostly with a director? You want to please your director?
No. I don't think. No. You got to please yourself. Okay. And you have to have a high bar on that.
Right.
And
I ask silly questions like that because I've never acted, so I don't know. I'm asking from a place of ignorance.
It's not silly, and I confess that's how you feel when you first start out. You want to please. But when you mature, you realize, oh, if I just focus on having high standards for pleasing myself in getting this character really specific and really understood and present that, that's doing my job. And that will bring appreciation from your director. Mm-hmm. What I look for in a director is a willingness to collaborate, a willingness to be open, a sensibility of, of saying, I don't know. Jay Roach is like that, who admits when they're not quite sure on something. Steven Soderbergh was like that. I worked with him on a movie called Contagion. Lawrence Fishburne and I blocked out this entire walk and talk scene, and he just looked at us, and he's thinking, and he goes, this is not working. And of course, Fish and I are thinking, what did we do? You know what? And he goes, no, not you guys. It's me. This is an ill-conceived idea. I need 10 minutes. And so the assistant director said, everybody take 10 minutes, and he wanted everybody to leave, just so he can be alone with his thoughts on that set and figure out what he did wrong in blocking and where the camera should be and think. And after 10 minutes, we were all asked to come back in. He goes, okay, I got it. This is my mistake. You should be here. We should be here. You're here and you walk, and we changed it around and he was happy. And it was like, okay. And I really appreciated his ability to say, I'm not sure, or I don't know. You know, or I made a mistake, because that to me makes me want to embrace that director and say, how can we help? You know, we're all in this together.
Right. You mentioned Jay Roach. You've just had two awfully good collaborations with him.
Yeah.
And in both cases, you played real life people, which is another subject I want to discuss with you. When I saw Trumbo last year, one of the things that struck me about it was I saw no trace of you on that screen. I just saw Dalton Trumbo. Now, I never met him, unfortunately. I've seen pictures of him. I think I've seen some interview footage with him from time to time. But that wasn't what I was carrying in my head. I just saw a creation, a figure come to life, and it had no There was no evidence of Bryan Cranston, just Dalton Trumbo.
Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that.
I mean it as such. But how do you know when you... And then, of course, LBJ in All the Way. Now, I didn't get to see you do it on stage, unfortunately. I wish I had. But I saw the HBO movie, which was great.
Thank
now,
you.
I am old enough to remember Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah.
There it is, folks. Can't help. I have to admit it. But I remember him very, very well. And I've seen him portrayed by other people, too, with varying degrees of success or fidelity, whatever you want to call it. But you were him. My God. You're the LBJ I remember.
Thank you.
That's who I remember seeing and hearing, you know, when I was growing up, in those turbulent years after, you know, JFK's assassination. Mm-hmm. So to yourself, not in conversation with your director necessarily, when do you say to yourself, all right, I've got it?
It's more of a feeling than anything else. Whenever you start a project, the character, for me, is always outside of me. And then you start the process. And the process consists of applying your talent. And I don't want to have false modesty. Mm-hmm. You have to have confidence in your talent.
Of course.
Or you should not be in this business.
Right.
A second is the joy of your research to read. To talk to people who knew the men, in this case, fairly recent history. Mm-hmm. And ironically, they both had two daughters, and both of them are still alive mm-hmm. in both sets of Johnson and Trumbo, and very cooperative, very helpful to me. Mm-hmm. And I confess to them my intention. I don't want to do an impersonation of your father, and I am not going to, I'm not going to try to act like him. I'm going to make him the my sensibility of who I think he is. That's the best I can do.
Mm-hmm.
Your help would be greatly appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an interest in getting me close to their father's sensibility as well. So they helped. I talked to lawyers who are friends of him, of both people, and a lot of different people. And then there's the biographies.
Mm-hmm.
Multitude of biographies, obviously, on LBJ. His own autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Just the audio tapes that are famous.
Oh, yes, of course. The infamous audio tapes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you know, Trumbo had his own personal writings, his movies that he mm-hmm. wrote. There's sensibilities and messages in those movies. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of research.
A lot. Then you use your own imagination to connect the dots and your own personal history of men of that age. And you put it all together, and it's like creating a bouquet of flowers from a variety of selection possibilities. And you add this, and you add some of this, and you add some of this. And sometimes you look at it and you go, oh, that's too busy. I'm going to put this back, and I got to put that back, and I need this. And you don't know what that bouquet is going to look like when you finally get it together and present it to the director, to the audience. But hopefully you get it. At some point, that character, through osmosis of some sort, seeps into you. And when that happens, and you don't know when it's going to happen, you trust that it will. When it happens, you present that thing, and you feel much more confident. From that point on, you're thinking and feeling and responding through the filter of that character.
Mm-hmm.
Like on LBJ, I would stay in character between takes because it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it also was comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helped me stay in that mentality of being in the early 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship between the sexes or the between subordinates,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that sort of thing. It was really important for me to stay in that mix, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed it. I really did. And Dalton Trumbo was the same way.
Hmm. With LBJ, did you find even the period clothing gave you some sense of – I mean, he was like all men of that era, more formal. I mean, not on his ranch,
no.
but in his public life
yeah.
and in the White House, certainly, more formal, the shirt's a little stiffer.
Yeah. The man in the gray flannel suit
yeah.
uh-huh. sort of
mm-hmm.
appeal. And it always made – we were boys during that time, and it always made us think that – we couldn't identify age. Everybody looked the same. Yeah. They're in gray suits or brown suits or whatever. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know. They're all old.
And hats.
And hats. And they wore the hats.
Happened. Well, now hats are coming back, but they look funky. Anyway,
yeah.
They look good on those guys because they look right on those guys.
Yeah, it does. Definitely. I mean, there's a general consensus that the American approach for an actor is to work from the inside out. First, find the character. Mm-hmm. Let that character live within you. And that will then inform how he wears his hair, what kind of clothes he wears. Does he have good dental hygiene? Does he, you know, facial hair or not? Does he, you know, all those things will be informed. And they sense, and, you know, it's not exactly a strict, you know, rule, but they say that the more British approach is work from the outside in.
Well, that was the Olivier legend.
Right.
That once he found the nose, or once he found, you know, the wig or the character makeup, he then found the key to his character.
Yeah. I think both are fair. The point is, did you get to the character? Did you find the character? If you did, it doesn't matter how
Olivier
you got
seems
there.
To have done it pretty well.
He did very well. And it does work that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you and I were sitting here, and not in casual clothes, but in tuxedos, we would feel very different in our posture.
We would sit differently.
We would sit differently. We would act differently. Mm-hmm. We would hold ourselves differently. Mm-hmm. There's just certain things that change you once you put them on.
One of the things we like to do, I'm using the royal we because my daughter, my co-host, isn't here today. But one of the things we like to do is to ask our guests if there's some movies you would like to recommend that you think are good but don't have the audience they deserve. Maybe they're underappreciated or, you know, hidden gems in a way. And any come to mind?
Well, the first thing that pops in my mind, I saw a movie called The Lobster. Fairly recently with Colin Farrell. And I really enjoyed it. It was a bizarre kind of dystopian world that that these characters live in. And without giving it away, they need to, in a world where you need to find a mate. And if you're not properly mated, then you turn into an animal. For eternity, and they give you a what they consider is a fair amount of time. So all the people who are not necessarily socially adept find themselves at risk of turning in. And Colin Farrell, who you see him like you've never seen him before, he gained 40 pounds. He completely changed his look and his appearance and his gait and his posture and everything. And really took on this character of a milquetoast kind of guy. And, and it was very intriguing to me. I don't know if you like that movie or not.
You know, I'm going to have to just come out and say it. I missed it.
You did.
I did.
Well, see, then this is a good recommendation.
It is a good recommendation. No, you're not the first to recommend it. And I meant to get to it. Missed the press screenings and never caught up with it. So it's on my to-do list.
Good.
As the year winds down and I'm checking off ones that I didn't get to see.
Yeah.
So you've exposed me right here, and I will make a vow that I will see The Lobster.
Yeah.
Did you see A Swiss Army Man?
I have not.
All right, then I'll trade you that
one.
So
I'll trade you? Okay.
A Swiss Army Man is a rather amazing. Did you see it, Katie? I'm asking Katie, who's sitting over here with her headset on. That's a rather amazing movie, too, that's hard to describe.
It is.
To put it mildly, with Paul Dano and Daniel Radcliffe. A rather extraordinary film that I'd rather not discuss too much.
I know the premise of it. So, I just want to go see it.
When you were growing up, were there films that really made a lasting impression on you?
Oh, sure.
I'm sure there must have been some.
I saw probably a half a dozen years too early. The Graduate, when I was 12 years old.
A little young,
but it twisted me around because I was, you know, prepubescent and starting to feel differently about the girl who was in my class, and what does that mean to me? I don't know. I don't know what to do with this feeling. It's rare and awkward, and I saw that movie, at a time when there was some turmoil in my family, mm-hmm. and it was kind of an escape, and we weren't very governed by our parents at that mm-hmm. time. It's like, wherever I go, you know. And we saw this movie, and I thought, oh, my God, I really related to Dustin Hoffman's character and being kind of confused in life mm-hmm. type of thing. And to have this assertive, sexy woman, older woman, mm-hmm. just take control was a whole new thing to me. And mm-hmm. I thought – and I remember thinking, like, I think I talked to my brother about it, who was 2 years older than me, mm-hmm. and I kind of like – I thought every couple I've seen up until that point, I guess, seemed to be about the same age. And I just thought that was kind of a rule that you had to be with the same age, or maybe the parts didn't fit otherwise, or I don't know. But yeah, that really had a mark on me. I remember when we saw, of course, the shot between the legs with the stockings mm-hmm. and very provocative when he jumps on the pool float mm-hmm. and then he's actually cut, Mike Nichols cuts, and he's yeah. on top of her, and all these things were just yeah. so profound to impressionable young boy.
Indeed. And to others too. I saw it at just the right age. I think I was 17 or 18.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
yeah. Man. What
it's
a
film. Eye-opener.
What a film. What a year that was.
Yeah. And a beautiful, beautiful the ending of it was so wonderful, too. And, you know, we're talking about Mike Nichols. I wish I could have worked with him. I did meet him, and he came backstage. And,
oh, how nice.
Yeah, it was fun. The ending was fantastic. You know, we victory. The two lovers,
right.
you know,
yes. oh, it's
away on their own, and then on the bus, now what? Yeah.
It's an extraordinary ending. Yeah. Remains extraordinary after yeah. all these years. Hasn't yeah. lost any of that impact, I think. One last thing out of the blue here, but you've done a lot of animation. You've done a lot of voice work for animation,
yeah.
For features, for television, for wacko television.
yeah, I do, yeah.
So am I inferring from that you enjoy it?
I do. It's, you know, a way to tell a story just with your voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Your inflection, the sensibility, even the pauses, how can you convey certain emotions if they can't really see you? They're yeah. just seeing a puppet or they're seeing
yeah.
– so I've really jumped in. I enjoy it. I'm producing and voicing a series, an animated series called Super Mansion
mm-hmm.
that is on Crackle. .com
mm-hmm.
and which is great, and we're going into our second season on that. I also did kind of a sci-fi animated thing. I used to do a lot of voices on Power Rangers
mm-hmm.
that series when it first came out. I was glad to have a job
mm-hmm.
and I just recently did a role on the movie version of Power Rangers, so I'm coming full circle on that. And that was a lot of fun too. So, yeah, I'm doing a lot of that. I just, again, story.
Well, which means that maybe if you had been around some decades earlier, you might have enjoyed being a radio actor. Because
yeah.
I've interviewed a lot of the veterans of. I wrote a book about old time radio and interviewed a lot of those actors who just adored that medium.
Yeah.
For just the reasons that you started to say. That it's all in your voice. It has nothing to do with your looks.
No.
Nothing at all.
No.
So there were a lot of people who became character actors and actresses on television because that's how they looked.
Yes.
But on radio, they were femme fatales,
that's
leading
right.
men. They could be anything their voice would allow them to be.
That's right. William Conrad comes
oh,
to
yes,
mind.
Of course. Yes.
The voice of Matt Dillon on yes. Gunsmoke.
Yes. The incredible voice.
Yeah. Great voice.
Incredible.
Great, gravelly voice. I'll tell you, Doc. You know, this whole
yeah.
thing. And he was a short, rotund.
And later starred in a TV series called Cannon, where he played
Cannon.
To put it as plainly
right.
as possible, a fat detective.
Yes, or yeah. Jake and the Fat
Jake
Man.
Jake and the Fat Man, that's
was,
right.
He was
that's
the,
right.
the latter part
yes.
of that titular.
Yes, but no one could, I mean, no disrespect to James Arness, But Matt Dillon was brought to life just magnificently on radio.
Yeah, it really was. I still love listening to the old shows.
Oh, well, I do too.
The old radio shows.
Yeah, they're great.
They're fun, especially on road trips. You can just...
Oh, perfect.
Fantastic.
Perfect for road trips. Yes, yes. Take that tip, friends. And take a tip and watch anything Bryan Cranston is in, because the odds are very, very good that you will not be wasting your time. And are you working with Wes Anderson? Did I read that that is happening?
That's another animated project, yes. Mm-hmm. Wes Anderson, they called The Isle of Dogs. And we did a recording, and I was in the booth, in this large booth with Bob Balaban and Ed Norton and Wes and Bill Murray and mm-hmm. I, all of us in the booth together doing this. And it was like surreal and wonderful to be able to do that. I haven't well, that was a little while ago, so I don't know when it's
animation old. Takes time.
It takes forever.
Yeah.
So The Isle of Dogs will come out.
Worth waiting for, I'm sure. Wonderful. Yeah. And tell us a little about that farce that you said is coming the end of the year.
That's called Why Him? Mm-hmm. It stars myself and James Franco mm-hmm. and Keegan-Michael Key and mm-hmm. Megan Mullally, and a really, really fun cast. And a real kind of a risk for me, because it was kind of a broad body comedy. And the reason I wanted to do it was I like the basic story. It's the story of a guy, older guy, has a young daughter going to college. Zoe Deutsch plays my daughter wonderfully, and she falls for an older guy. She falls for James Franco, and the obviously it's like, why him? Why right. would you choose this guy? And he's not the perfect person.
Okay.
But it's very funny, and it comes out at Christmas.
Sounds it. Are you a social media type of person?
Yeah, I do.
Where
social.
Where can people find you?
I
if they want to find.
I'm on Twitter at Bryan Cranston, Bryan.
Exposing yourself to the world.
Cranston, yeah. I like that just little things that I can send out, you know, about my book coming out or whatever.
That's
wonderful. And things
book.
I'm doing.
And the book again is called?
A Life in Parts.
Published by?
Published by Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster. And,
a very distinguished publisher.
Yeah, I'm going to go on tour. Like one city per day and do an event of readings and things like that. And you can find that on
Take vitamin C.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I've done that. Take vitamin C, echinacea.
Yeah, I have to be very regimented.
Have protein bars with you.
Yep.
Yeah. All that. Bryan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Leonard.
You can find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin, if you should care to do so, and online at leonardmaltin.com. And you can find us, usually, Jesse and I, right here on this podcast. We hope to see you next time. Thanks for tuning in.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.